Good afternoon. Good afternoon. I'm Eugene Meyer, President of the Society, and I want to welcome all of you to our annual Rosenkranz debate, which is something we've always done done for years on lunch on Saturday. And without further ado, I want to turn it over to our moderator, Eugene Volokh, Professor Volokh, who's now the Thomas Siebel Senior Fellow at Hoover for years, taught at UCLA, and is one of the leading, if not the leading, First Amendment scholars in the country to moderate the debate. Eugene.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the kind introduction. Thank you even more for the very kind invitation. This is obviously a tremendously important event every year at the meeting. But this one is particularly interesting because it's a really interesting, important question. I don't know what the right answer is. I look forward to hearing what the participants tell us all about this. So the format is that each side will have 12 minutes at the outset and then a 5-minute rebuttal. I'm going to be moderately militant in time enforcement. In the interest of time, these are quite long biographies, and they are only a short portion of what it is that our illustrious panelists have done. Let me just very quickly mention a few highlights. Pat Philbin is a partner at Torridon Law, which I was always quite puzzled by. Apparently, it's a Scottish thing. So there you go. It's apparently a lovely place in Scotland, and a law firm. Among many, many other accomplishments, from December 2018 to January 2021, he served as deputy counsel to the president. Miguel Estrada is a partner at Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher. And among his many, many other accomplishments, he's argued 24 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court and, of course, many other courts and briefed still many more cases. Those are the panelists. The issue is, the resolution is resolved that Congress can ban TikTok. I suppose maybe some quibbling about virtually every one of those words. But let me just leave it to the panelists. So Pat. Over to you.
Thank you, Eugene. So let me start with a little bit of background. I think probably almost everyone knows what TikTok is, but just in case there are some in the audience. TikTok's a social media app. You can download it onto a phone or tablet, mobile device, and then it allows you to share short videos. So it's a video sharing app. It's one of the most popular apps in the world. There are 170 million monthly active users in the United States, and over 1 billion monthly active users worldwide. And what makes it so popular, or some would say so addictive, the sort of special sauce is the recommendation algorithm that recommends to users in a for you part of the app a constant stream of new videos to watch. So you're getting everything from other users to look at all these videos. And the way the algorithm works is that TikTok sucks up huge amounts of data from the users. So it sucks up your precise location, your contacts list from your phone, your video history, what you've looked at, browsing history, and things like that in order to come up with the recommendations in the algorithm for new videos for you to look at. The other thing that's important to the debate and it'll come up is that TikTok is owned by a company called ByteDance, which is headquartered in Beijing. It's incorporated in the Cayman Islands, but it has its headquarters in China. Why ban TikTok? Well, as the father of two 11-year-old going on 12-year-old girls, I could give you a lot of reasons to ban TikTok. They're probably not sufficient for Congress to ban TikTok, so I'll focus on that. And the simple answer is national security. And it's this layer of ownership that has ByteDance headquartered in Beijing that creates the problem, because under Chinese national security and cybersecurity laws, any company operating in China is obligated to cooperate with requests from the government, from the CCP, to provide any information that they have, and to do it in secret, so that they would be handing over information that would include all this information gathered from U.S. users to the government in China. And so why is that a problem? Well, all of this information and gathering this furthers Chinese intelligence efforts. And this is something that has been explained by the director of the FBI and the DNI to Congress, that Chinese espionage efforts have a pattern of trying to acquire these huge data sets on Americans. So how many here were in the George W. Bush administration? Is there anybody who, yeah. So the Chinese have all your information because they hacked OPM. So they've got your social security number, they've got your SF-86, every place you lived for 20 years before you went into the Bush administration. And then in addition to the OPM hack, they hacked Equifax and got financial data on about half of all American adults. They hacked Anthem and got healthcare data on tens of millions of Americans. And the Chinese then, part of their espionage and intelligence operation is to use supercomputers and now AI to layer all these data sets together. And it's incredibly valuable to them to then build dossiers on people so that they can use that for intelligence efforts for potential targeting. They can figure out who works on military bases, who works in government agencies, people to target. Director of the FBI, Chris Wray, told Congress that TikTok is perhaps one of the most important surveillance tools on the planet. And so that's another thing it can be used for, and this actually happened after some information about TikTok was leaked to journalists. Engineers within TikTok, in China and in the United States, looked for and found the precise location data for those journalists because they had the TikTok app on their phones and tracked them to try to find out who their sources were. So that's something else that can be done with this as an intelligence tool. Then there's another national security concern, which is simply that there is software that is controlled by the app sitting on the handsets of 170 million Americans. And Chris Wray explained to Congress, the director of the FBI also, that this creates a vulnerability, and it's part of a pattern also of Chinese intelligence efforts, because they hack into infrastructure and then kind of hang out there waiting to be able to deploy malware at the most opportune time to cause maximum disruption. And so having this software on phones creates a vulnerability that could potentially be used, the FBI has told Congress, to disrupt communications at a time when it would be most opportune. So there are huge national security concerns. That's why Congress, so when I say ban TikTok, what I think we're really talking about here is that Congress can ban that ownership layer that runs through a company that is headquartered in Beijing. And that's what Congress did earlier this year. There is a statute that was passed to ban that ownership layer of a company operating in China over TikTok. What are the concerns with that? Why would that be a problem? And the issue that's been raised is First Amendment concerns, because it's a huge platform on TikTok for speech. But I think you have to kind of sort through more specifically whose First Amendment rights are we talking about. And one First Amendment angle that has been raised is, well, TikTok, when it uses its algorithm and curates this flow of videos, it's editing and gathering speech, TikTok has speech. But to sort of cut right to the chase on that, there was a CFIUS order requiring TikTok to divest an acquisition in the United States, which led to a lot of negotiations with the government about whether there's something short of divestiture that could work. And in the course of those negotiations, it became clear a few things. One is that the algorithm was created in China and requires software engineers in China to be constantly updating and maintaining it. And the Chinese government has made clear they will never allow that algorithm and the intellectual property and the code to be sold or moved out of China. And for the algorithm to work, for this special sauce to work, it has to keep getting information from American users. So what that means is that to the extent there's speech coming from this algorithm selecting what videos, it's speech from a foreign entity in a foreign country that's just being shoved over into the United States. The TikTok, or ByteDance, the parent company, has no First Amendment right to do that. So then you're talking about, well, what about the First Amendment rights of users in the United States who want to see the videos? But or post their own videos. But they don't have a First Amendment right to a particular app, to a particular platform to put their speech on. They can put their stupid cat videos on Facebook, on YouTube, they can put them on Twitter. There are lots of other avenues. And I think what that shows is that the right analysis under the First Amendment here is that a restriction from Congress on ownership is regulating conduct. It's regulating conduct that then may have an incidental effect on speech. And so you're in the world of United States versus O'Brien with an intermediate level of scrutiny at most. And what you have to show is an important or substantial government interest, check, national security, that is not related to the suppression of speech, check, and that does not have more restrictive effect on speech than necessary to obtain the goal. And I think this is where, in the actual case for the statute Congress passed, a lot of the debate has focused on, is there something less restrictive? Like, instead of complete divestiture of the ownership, could you have a firewall of some sort? Can you just keep the U.S. data in the U.S. and keep it separate and have some third party like Oracle monitoring it? Is there something that works? Now, I can tell you what the United States has told the court, which is, again, coming from these negotiations around the CFIUS order, the answer is no. There is nothing that actually creates a firewall, because it's essential for that algorithm to work, for it has to stay in China, and it has to keep getting information from U.S. users. So I think that's the reason Congress can ban it that is the clearest. It's a national security concern. It's regulating ownership. It needs only intermediate scrutiny, and it easily survives. So I will, though, if I have a couple more.
You have 3 minutes.
All right, okay. I think where the debate, though, could be a lot more interesting legally, I think where there's a more difficult legal issue is potentially if Congress has or used another rationale, and that rationale being that this TikTok app could be used for a covert influence operation on Americans, because the algorithm could be manipulated to covertly start pushing certain narratives, pushing certain information to all the Americans. Now, here's the scariest thing that I learned preparing for this. According to a Pew Research study from 2024, 40% of Americans aged 18 to 30 report regularly getting their news from TikTok. That's their source of news. Now, we know from the recent election that sort of the legacy media is probably dying in its influence. I didn't think the alternative was TikTok, but apparently for a certain age cohort, it is. And that creates a concern that there could potentially be covert manipulation of the messages coming across from TikTok. So
you would like the alternative to be Facebook? Noted.
So, now, the First Amendment analysis on that potentially is very different, because you're talking about what sounds like a content-based reason for regulating that ownership structure. But there again, TikTok itself doesn't have First Amendment rights. They don't have a right to be pushing propaganda from the CCP into the United States from abroad. And the argument that's been raised is that Americans have a right to receive information. And there's a case, Lamont versus the Postmaster General, Justice Douglas' opinion from the 60s, from 1965, that had to do with material being mailed in from communist countries and a restriction on that. And the court held Americans have a right to be receiving information from abroad. But here's the key distinction that I think would be relevant for a justification for banning TikTok. It was very clear in Lamont what that material was. I mean, it was postmarked from communist countries. It was avowedly coming in as information from the USSR or the PRC. And there is a clear strain in American jurisprudence suggesting that the government has an interest in ensuring that if Americans are getting information that is from foreign governments, they at least know it's coming from foreign governments. That's part of the whole rationale for the Foreign Agents Registration Act, for FARA, which started out as the McCormick Act in 1938 in response to Nazi propaganda, so that there can at least be knowledge on behalf of the recipients that it is coming from a foreign government. The problem here is that it would be a covert influence operation. We would never know, and you could never label, what is it coming on TikTok that would be part of a covert influence operation or not. You can't have that labeling. And so that provides a rationale for Congress to stop that layer of ownership that creates the threat of the covert influence operation. So as I say, that's where I think the debate's a lot more interesting and edgier on First Amendment law. And so I thought I would bring it up.
Interesting and edgy. All right. Miguel, over to you.
All right. I mean, I think Pat is an excellent lawyer, and he did, you know, the best that he could to put a lot of lipstick on a pig. I think we can start with sort of outlining, you know, the areas of agreement. China, Russia, Iran, North Korea are, you know, what Congress calls foreign adversaries. You know, they might even be strategic enemies. Those people are totalitarian, you know, societies. They're police states. They put, you know, their citizens into sort of slave camps. They're not nice people. They're totalitarian police states. We are not. They have, as Justice Scalia used to say, beautifully, exquisitely written, detailed constitutions that they don't follow. We have a short one that we do follow. So that's, you know, the key, you know, difference, you know, between us and them. You know, in describing what's troublesome about this particular app, I think Pat did a good job in highlighting what the executive branch has stated in public. He did not actually sort of state what Congress said or what it put in the law that actually banned this. And what Congress said and what it put in the law is sort of important because, you know, the concerns that Congress had were, number one, about, you know, the use of the app for propaganda, which is we are concerned about what's appearing in the app. Too many Palestinian flags. The fact that the Osama bin Laden sort of manifesto went viral. This will be used to channel Chinese propaganda over Taiwan. All of the stuff that they don't want to read in it. There are too many cat videos that will rot, you know, the mind of our teenagers. All the stuff that you look at and sort of smacks of content. We don't like what we are reading. And if you look at this, you would say, well, that's fine, write something else and persuade him that this is dumb and stupid. This is how a free society usually deals with these things. In saying that you have to divest of this, one of the conditions for a successful divestiture that Congress made is that at the end of the road, if you succeed jumping all the hoops, is that you could not have an algorithm, and I'm quoting, that has any cooperation with respect to the content recommendation algorithm with an entity in one of these countries. And so although you have a First Amendment right to associate yourself with somebody else in a foreign country for the purpose of engaging in an editorial judgment, I could, if I want to, have a festival here that shows you all the films that won the Cannes Film Festival or the Venice Film Festival. I could do that. That's my First Amendment right, but I could not associate, you know, myself with somebody who will sort of help me curate, you know, what I want to recommend to my readers here, even after I successfully sever the link. I cannot take, you know, the recommendations of the Chinese Communist Party or of the Ayatollah. So it's content based on the face of the statute. And that was one of the driving concerns of the Congress in here. I don't want to short sell, you know, the fact that Congress may have had the concern about the potentiality of data abuse, but I do want to say that everything else that Congress took into account about what the facts are were not actually borne out in any record in front of Congress. There was a significant fight. I haven't actually looked at this because I'm not a judge and I didn't do an investigation, but Congress also did not do an investigation because it didn't put any of this in any record in front of it. And this is part of what will make, you know, the job of the DC Circuit that's looking at this very hard. There is a big fight about whether the company is actually owned by China. Company actually, TikTok, is owned by ByteDance, which is incorporated in the Cayman Island. It is majority owned by a whole bunch of investment funds that are U.S. and other foreign, non-Chinese, non-enemy owned all over the place. It is about 21% owned by a Chinese national that who lives in Singapore. And so one of the questions is, although to be sure the algorithm was, you know, developed in China and the intellectual property is Chinese in the sense that it cannot be transferred, is that the type of domination that would entitle the U.S. to say that this is controlled by the CCP? Interesting question. Maybe it could, but it's not borne out by the record. With respect to the First Amendment questions that go to the speech question, it is well settled in First Amendment law that Congress doesn't get to look at a potential danger and have a speech restriction unless the, you know, the restriction is actually going to fix the danger and is tailored to the danger. So you don't get to actually do that. But let me get to a more sort of fundamental problem, you know, with this, which, you know, this is sort of typical of statutes that get floated in Congress and get a million to zero votes. They're usually sort of an indication that nobody thought about it and that there's no evidence to actually bear them out. And just so that I explain to you how incredibly sort of head-scratching this is what the statute does. Side A of the menu, I will hold it up to give you a visual. It says TikTok, ByteDance, banned. They are controlled by a foreign adversary, China, very bad. China. Okay. I am following the plot so far. Side B of the menu, we're also going to have a general statute in which covered companies that we're going to define as those that are also controlled by foreign adversaries may also be banned if they're controlled by folks that are domiciled in China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, to the extent of more than 20%, if you're following me. They're not necessarily banned. They may be banned. If they have an app that has content, that has more than a certain number of followers per month, unless the company also has another app that is primarily devoted to, I don't know, travel or cooking, in which case, even if the app is run by the Ayatollah himself and is devoted to the sole purpose of bringing down the United States, the sister app, which is, you know, devoted to travel or cooking, saves the whole enterprise. But if they don't have the wits to have the sister app that is devoted to travel or cooking, in that case, you know, the president has the discretion to start an administrative process in which the app that is controlled by the foreign adversary will then have the opportunity to have a hearing with notice of what the problem is and the assets that maybe are the problem that should be divested. Now, you see the problem here. Side A of the menu says, TikTok, we don't actually tell you what exactly is going on or what you have done wrong. We're worried about the danger that you may be up to no good. We are not actually going to give you the list of the charges of what actually you have done, because everything that Pat just mentioned actually is public allegations that were not actually stated by Congress in any bill. And side B, we're worried about the same thing that could potentially, you know, describe the same company. You have an out if you want to have another app. And if you don't want to have another app, we're going to give you a hearing in which, you know, they're going to, you know, the president has to make findings, and there's going to be an administration, an administrative process, and you're going to have a hearing. And so if you're considering this from the point of view of the First Amendment, you would call that a less restrictive alternative that in the judgment of Congress is readily available. Now, multiple problems here. You are, by statute, canceling, you know, the speech of 170 million Americans. It is, from the point of view of the First Amendment, just, I don't want to say ludicrous. I mean, it's not tenable to say to a freelance writer or anybody who wants to communicate and who finds already, because they are on TikTok, that Facebook is not an acceptable substitute. If the government were to say today that they don't really trust Rupert Murdoch, we know that he became a naturalized U.S. citizen, but we think he's still really Australian or whatever, and we're going to force him to sell this Fox chain, not to worry, you can all go to MSNBC. Nobody would find that a credible argument. And by the way, you should also get rid of the Wall Street Journal. Everybody who writes for the editorial page will be welcome at the New York Times or the New Republic. Nobody would find that a credible argument. And if the government's view were, we're going to force you to close your doors, and find no congenial environment where you can publish, or find like-minded people where you can publish everything that you have to say, people will consider that a prior, you know, restraint. Now, there's an there is a separate aspect of this that I don't want to give short shrift, which is this data security thing. There's a dispute about this issue as to whether whether TikTok is in fact collecting data. As part of the security agreement that was, you know, negotiated but not actually reached, one of the things that the company did was put all of the U.S. data in a separate server that is run by Oracle, which is a U.S. company. Now, the government says that's not good enough. But again, given that, you know, Congress thought that there could be a process for every other company that looks and walks and quacks just like TikTok, there is a substantial question there as to whether you could really claim that this is not an appropriate means of safeguarding all of the government's interests. Again, just from a pure First Amendment interest. You can't really say that this is not speech by a U.S. company, because the government has conceded that TikTok, which is incorporated in California, which may be a better argument for its being communist than its being tied to China, is a U.S. citizen, is a U.S. speaker, is engaging in the curation of speech. Under the Moody Netroid case from last term, it is engaging, even if it's using foreign software, in the curation of speech. It is a U.S. speaker. The 170 million U.S. persons in the platform are speakers whose own speech is also being canceled by this statute. That is not an O'Brien case. That is a direct suppression of speech that is entitled to strict scrutiny, but even under intermediate scrutiny, it would fail because there are clearly lesser included alternatives, and none of this is tailored to the asserted dangers or sort of addressed to anything other than the speculative dangers that have been outlined by the government. There are all possibilities that this could happen, but nothing has been identified that actually has happened. And ultimately, given that, you know, Pat himself keeps pointing that all of these dangers could and have happened as a result of hacking every other American company like Equifax, and could continue to happen, there is no indication that any of this could actually fix a problem that is ongoing and that is a fixture of the electronic age. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Back 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. So I think one difficult part of this debate is between the more abstract proposition, can Congress ban TikTok, and then potential infirmities with the statute that has actually been passed. And I know that Miguel was focusing on some things about that statute. So one thing about that, you know, there are statements, as Miguel pointed out, I think in the congressional record related to that statute, that talk about concern about content on TikTok just in terms of it's too pro-Palestinian, or it led to people reading Osama bin Laden's letter and thinking that that was a great exegesis on the way the world should work or something. There are some more difficulties. Like, if that's Congress's rationale, it does raise a very different First Amendment complexion to this. I don't think, though, that part of the premise that Miguel was operating under is that Congress has to put in the statute its findings and it has to set out in the statute its rationale. I don't think that that works. That's not the way the Supreme Court has reviewed statutes from Congress. It's not an administrative agency that has to show its work. There were hearings, and in the hearings, the executive branch presented all the concerns that I was talking about, the national security concerns for access to data and for having the software on the handsets of 170 million Americans. I mean, remember, we have undertaken since the Trump administration and ongoing since then an effort to get Chinese-owned, Chinese-controlled hardware and software out of our telecommunications infrastructure. Huawei, ZTE, the FCC has decided you've got to rip it all out, can't have it. But if you have software that is potentially controlled by the CCP on the handset, the end point of the communications infrastructure, you still got a problem. And that is something that Congress could address. And I think that with Congress doesn't have to have actual findings in the statute to make that the justification. Now, Miguel pointed out there are questions about, is there a less restrictive alternative? Could you have this firewall? And again, I think that's difficult for us to debate here exactly what the facts are on that, because this is what the government submitted under oath to the DC Circuit. They said that in their negotiations with TikTok, quote, the company would never agree, and in the negotiations described above did not agree, to cease collecting U.S. user data or sending it to Beijing to train the algorithm. Nor could it or would it commit to moving the algorithm from the PRC to the United States to end data flows to the PRC. So that's what the government believes the case to be, is that it just won't work, and the companies told them it just won't work unless they keep the data flows going to train the algorithm in Beijing. And that's what leads to the national security problem. Miguel mentioned you're canceling the speech of 170 million Americans. Again, I don't think that that's true, because you have plenty of alternatives for where you want to put your videos. You can put your videos wherever you want. Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, there are lots of alternatives. But you don't have a right, and I think the Supreme Court made this clear in the Society for Accretion of Consciousness case, you don't have a right to a particular platform all the time anywhere where you want to put your speech. If there are alternatives available, that's not canceling the speech. By restricting the ownership, what Congress would be doing, focusing just on an ownership, and I should say a corporate structure that puts the parent entity under the control of the CCP, because it's headquartered in China. Whether the owners are 21% here and somebody on Singapore and someplace else, it's not ownership that matters. As long as the parent entity is headquartered in Beijing, that subjects it to the laws of the PRC, which require it, when asked, to turn over all the information. And if Congress wants to regulate that in order to stop the data flow that will just feed into the massive data sets that the CCP already has on Americans, I think that's a national security justification that withstands First Amendment scrutiny.
All right, thank you very much.
I should note that as an occasional appellate lawyer that Pat did not use his full time for rebuttal, which is usually thought of as a power move.
Miguel, over to you.
I think the fundamental problem is the persistent, denial of recognizing the uniqueness of the speech medium, whether you like it or not. I'm a person who types with two fingers, so the whole notion of an app and anything that has to do with this sort of brave new world is incomprehensible to me. But I think, the market vote with its feet, to sort of mix metaphors here, and all of these people are not in Facebook on all these apps for a reason. And to say that they can move to an alternative medium is to fail to recognize that they themselves have expressed that this is a medium that has a unique expression to them. Doctrinally, I think Pat is wrong because we have case law on this, right? I mean, we have people who have had yard signs in front of their house, you know, the city of Ladue case, where the municipality told them that that's unsightly and they should take them off. You know, they want, you know, Harris for president, and the municipality didn't want that. And, you know, the view of the city was you could root for her in some other medium. And the Supreme Court said, no, having this in front of your house is a unique medium of expression that cannot be, you know, replaced by a bumper sticker. And so you cannot forbid that. If somebody has a unique medium of expression that actually conveys that this is a house that supports Harris or, you know, Romney or Trump, you cannot close the medium of expression. And again, to say that the editorial choices that are conveyed by TikTok, the company based in California, are equivalent to those that are conveyed by Facebook or Elon Musk is to blink, you know, reality, and is really to, you know, deny the persuasiveness of the hypothetical I gave you by saying that Fox is the same thing as MSNBC. You could not say that you're going to shutter one because you have the option of going to a brand that is known for having a distinctly different editorial mix. Now, with respect to, you know, the putative national security risks, we also have doctrinal learning. I mean, you recall that governments have been trying to do stuff based on the apprehended potential danger since time immemorial. It wasn't that long ago that California was trying to slap labels on CDs because, you know, you might have like sex or danger or, you know, whatever, you know, the Brown case, where, you know, the court said, no, you cannot label these things based on the fact that, you know, people might become violent from listening to the Def Leppard or whatever. You might be right, but the danger is speculative, and before you restrict speech, you have to demonstrate that the dangers are real and that the solution actually will fix them. And so merely to posit that this might happen is not enough. You have to show how this will fix it. This will actually fix them enough to hinder the speech. You are doing something that, you know, demonstrably is keeping people from expressing themselves, and you have to justify that. That's what happens at the get-go here, that's a that's one of the most significant matters that we can do in this country. It is something that should be thought out and explained. It is not true that Congress is being treated like an administrative agency here. When you have a statute that on its face deals with the speech rights of Americans, you don't deal with it on a rational basis. If you have a record that expresses the concern of Congress as, oh, we don't like what they're saying, in fact, you're allowed to question whether this is content-based. That's what the law is. You don't hypothesize, as you do in rational basis review, that Congress might have had some hypothetical basis that, you know, they in fact never considered. This is not that type of inquiry. If you have something that on its face is content-based because it prohibits speech, you're required to consider it on the basis that it is content-based. You're not, you know, actually required to shut your eyes to the fact that it is content-based when it is. And whether you consider it as, you know, as strict scrutiny or intermediate scrutiny, it fails. But it's also important to note that even if you pretend that this is mostly, you know, directed at the conduct or, you know, the danger of data breaches or espionage or whatever under the O'Brien tests, it still fails. Because even under that doctrinal inquiry, it is a requirement that you not restrict more speech than necessary to accomplish that objective. And since Congress, in the very statute, has an alternative that has a more tailored sort of approach to the same problem, it is clearly, you know, the case that it itself does not think that that's the case here.
Thank you very much. So tremendously interesting and enlightening.
Pardon?
Are you going to tell us what you think?
Well, I was just about to say, I feel enlightened on both sides and still as uncertain about the answer as before. But I wanted to take the moderator's prerogative to ask each side a substantive question, and then I'll ask a quick procedural question. So Pat, let me ask you this. City of Ledoux versus Galeo, the case that you cited, it came to my mind as well. So this was a case where a city said people can't have any signs on their property because it creates visual blight. And it was, they said it was content neutral. It was an interesting question whether it was, but say it's content neutral. People have other alternative channels. They can stand out front and leaflet, or they can put up signs on the community bulletin board of the library or whatever else. And one of the things that the court said in striking it down is the other alternatives, some would be more expensive, some wouldn't carry the same message, but they also wouldn't reach the same audience. And an alternative is not an ample alternative channel if it keeps you from being able to reach pretty much the same audience. So as I understand it, TikTok has a vast international audience. So if people in America post something on TikTok, they can reach all their fellow American TikTok users potentially, as well as a wide range of foreign ones, not just in China, but in allied countries, England and the like, Canada. Even Australia, it's upside down there somehow, if TikTok is shut down and people can move maybe to Facebook, some people will move to Facebook, so you can't reach the ones who move to someplace other than Facebook, and you also can't reach the foreign TikTok users who are still there. So is that really an ample alternative channel when you may end up reaching an audience, but an audience very different than the one you wanted to reach?
So I think the answer to City of Ledoux versus Galeo is that the court did say in part that one thing to consider is would it be reaching the same audience, but a big part of that analysis, I think, also was that this is banning entirely a very important traditional form, traditional forum where people have long been able to put up their views on their own property to be able to state a view through a sign or something like that. And here, you don't have quite that same sort of traditional forum aspect. And you're not shutting off the forum entirely because people can put their videos up on Facebook, on Twitter, which also have international audiences. And so I think in my preferred statute, which would be based just on the national security grounds, and you'd be squarely in United States versus O'Brien analysis, because you're not regulating the content, you're just regulating the ownership. And if TikTok wanted to separate itself from the company that's headquartered in the PRC, from ByteDance, you could have TikTok, and they can construct whatever international sort of system they want, as long as they don't have that ownership in China. People can go to alternatives that are also international, like Twitter, Facebook, YouTube. I think that leaves plenty of alternative avenues for speech. It's not like it's shutting down, saying, I think the more closer analogy to City of Ledoux would be saying, you can't post videos on the internet. We're not gonna have a sharing app that allows you to do that. This allows plenty of avenues for people to do that. They can reach international audiences. And the only way to address the national security concern about the data flows to the PRC would be to take out that layer of ownership, and regulating that conduct, I think, has only an incidental effect on the speech and can be justified.
Got it. Thanks very much. Miguel, let me ask you this. So,
Before you ask me that question, I'm not exactly Dino De Laurentiis, and I don't, do film, but it strikes me, and I understand that one of the things that draws people to TikTok is not merely that you can sort of, record a video like I might with my camera and post it, is that they have tools that come with the algorithm or with the technology that allows them to do things that are not as easily doable with other apps. And so it is not merely that they have other channels of expression, it's that the tools for creativity are not as available in the other apps. So it's like telling me that I can sort of rent, you know, the movie theater, but the actors and the movie, you know, director sadly will not be available.
Got it. Pat, are you Dino De Laurentiis?
No.
Oh.
Definitely not.
But do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I haven't heard that particular argument. I haven't seen that in the briefing in the D.C. Circuit case, that there are particular tools. But again, I think editing and software tools can be replicated. I mean, it's hard for me to debate a factual issue that I don't really know that much about, but I would think that you can, in any software editing and video editing program, be able to replicate something similar enough that it is a substitute in this circumstance.
Got it. So Miguel, let me ask you this. So I totally appreciate the value of looking at all of these precedents that are structurally similar, like Ledoux and like Lamont and such. But just one thing that comes to mind is sometimes quantity has a quality all its own. So here you've got this app, which is 170 million. That's one.
Let's leave Lizzo out of this, but okay.
So this is one half of the U.S. population. Mm-hmm. I mean, the closest analog is back in the day when the broadcast networks might have somewhere close to that. And as I understand it, I'm not an expert on federal communications policy, but my understanding is for a long time we have had limits on foreign ownership of American broadcasters, and other limits on ownership that are somewhat even more aggressive at times. So I guess I'm wondering if in 1970 it turned out that some Soviet consortium, they didn't have the money or the expertise, but let's say they did.
Nikita Khrushchev in 1965 wanted to buy NBC. Is that your hypothetical?
Yes, although would have been Brezhnev by then. So let's say they decided to buy NBC.
I defer to you very superior knowledge of the Soviet Empire.
Yeah, exactly. So they decided that they wanted to buy NBC. I take it our reaction might be, look, we're all in favor of free speech. We also are aware that Lamont, the Postmaster General, said that if foreign governments want to send material by mail to the few Americans who actually solicit them, the Americans' listener interests prevail. But, you know, that's a tiny thing. That doesn't matter almost at all. Whereas if a foreign adversary has control of one of the three broadcast networks, mm-hmm. we're just not in an area that the precedents have really spoken to, because they haven't really dealt with something of this magnitude, of this potential significance, even if we're just talking about possible risk rather than immediate present danger. What do you think about that?
No. There are sort of a couple of things that are very, very different about that. Like, you know, the first one is that you're dealing with broadcasting, which in the fantasy world of the Supreme Court is licensed, and it's entirely based on a resource, the public sort of airwaves, that are licensed and controlled to a degree that otherwise would be not allowed by the First Amendment, because it's scarce and owned by the government. And that may or may not last, but according to the Supreme Court, it allows the government to exercise a degree of First Amendment control that otherwise would never be allowed elsewhere. That's point one. Point two is that even with respect to, you know, the New York Times, if you change the hypothetical, I don't think the situation is analogous. If the situation were one where the Soviet Union or China or, you know, whatever were proposing to come into the country and start a media empire, and there were no one in the U.S. that were already exercising speech rights, and it were just a question of a foreigner trying to come in and exercise First Amendment rights, your point of departure would be foreigners don't have First Amendment rights, go away. Here you have a situation that's already existing when you have an American company, and there is no allegation that TikTok is a sham company at all, that is domiciled in California that is engaged in ongoing speech with 170 million Americans. And if you come into the play when there's already speech going on and you want to intervene and change the status quo at that point, your burden of justification is much different. It is much different if you want to have prophylactic rules dealing with foreign investment in media when speech is not ongoing than when you want to interrupt and cancel speech that is ongoing. And so I hear you that governments have plenary powers over borders if you're not going to interfere with ongoing speech by our citizens, and if your argument is going to be, I may interfere with the ability of citizens to receive foreign speech in the future, in which case your sole argument would be, how broad is the Lamont case? Is it merely a right to receive, or is it broader? But then you would not be faced with the case here, which is you are coming in the middle of the play where there is already a very vibrant sort of free speech situation involving 170 million Americans who, for reasons of their own, as they're allowed to do in a free country, have concluded that this is the medium of expression that best conveys, you know, their needs and aspirations and allows them to communicate with their fellow citizens and with others in the world. And that sort of stuff is allowed in a free country.
Got it.
Thanks. So here's one thing that I thought was not allowed in our free country, but it turns out I was mistaken, and that is fact-finding at the DC circuit level without an initial agency record or district court decision. Damn it, that is a hill worth dying on. So I wanted to ask, so it turns out, obviously, this does occasionally happen, this vesting of the initial jurisdiction in the DC circuit, but I'm just curious how it would play out. So I don't necessarily want a kind of a mini debate on this. I actually am curious. There are factual disputes. There are sworn statements, but obviously, even if you don't think the declarants are lying, there might be disagreements about the underlying facts. How is it the DC Circuit supposed to resolve that?
I think it presents a difficult question. I mean, I could say from my own experience, reading the briefs and the declarations, in the reply brief, the lawyers for TikTok say, no, you don't. No user, U.S. user data goes back to Beijing. It doesn't need to train the algorithm anymore. The government's flatly taken the position that TikTok told them the special sauce won't work, the algorithm won't work unless it gets data, which tends to make sense because the algorithm needs the data to be able to come up with recommendations. So I'm not sure how they'll deal with that. I think it's a problem.
Got it. Miguel.
Well, I mean, two questions in your question. One of them is, how would a court deal with this? Well, you know, the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction. This is not an unusual case. You could have a fact-finding process if fact-finding were relevant to a case. I don't think fact-finding is relevant to this case, and the effort of the government to try to put sort of declarations and affidavits, it's sort of, you know, beside the point. It seems to me that on the face of the statute, you can figure out whether it's content-based or not, and there is a legislative record that you can look at or not. If this were an ordinance passed by Milwaukee, nobody would be obsessing about this. It would, you know, they would look at it and say it's either consistent with the First Amendment or it isn't. Mm-hmm. And it is only, you know, the gravity of assessing, you know, an act of Congress and whether it's constitutional that gives people agita. I mean, one of the things that I found odd about this is that after the statute was passed and it was challenged in the DC Circuit, you know, the government ran to the DC Circuit with a classified ex parte submission. Now, there's no contention that this classified submission was in front of Congress when they passed the statute. How on earth it could justify the constitutionality of the statute sort of escapes me.
Sorry, but just on that, I'm pretty sure that there were classified briefings for Congress.
No, I think what
the background for the act.
I think there were some classified briefings that conveyed conclusions to some members of Congress. But this brings us back to the famous sort of argument that Justice Scalia used to have about the relevance of legislative history, which is if you have some statement that was conveyed to somebody or some statement that somebody made about what the intent was that was in the mind of a legislature, does that tell you anything about what Congress intended in enacting this or the collective wisdom that they intended to bring or their intent or what any of the language means? And so is it therefore relevant to the court's assessment of what this means, what was intended, or like anything in the case?
Okay, so thank you very much to the panelists, to the debaters. We have time for questions, and I'm gonna try to be able to see people's hands. Yeah, I think actually the visor model seems to work pretty well. Okay, so yeah, I guess that's right. People just approach the microphones.
Yeah, the issue is hard to see in the room.
So I see vaguely some human-like shapes right in front of me.
Thank you, yeah.
First human-like shape, you wanna identify yourself and?
Yeah, Will Trachman from Colorado, human-like shape speaking. For Mr. Estrada, it sounds like I can't really tell your opinion on the resolution itself. Can Congress ban TikTok? And suppose TikTok were to say anyone who expresses pro-Taiwanese views will go ahead and dox them and publish their most embarrassing cat videos. Is there a scenario in which you would be agreeable with the resolution?
Generally, prior restraints are not consistent with the First Amendment, and so probably not. And so, I mean, if TikTok were publishing, you know, war plans in time of war, and we were in a shooting war with China, and they were about to tell you when we're launching, like, you know, missiles, in a time to warn the Chinese, you could probably ban that. And so, you know, it depends what the question is, but, you know, one of the doctrinal sort of bedrock points of the First Amendment is you generally don't ban speech, you combat it with more speech. If your point is that the speech is going to cause harm, you examine that extremely carefully. I mean, don't forget that one of the leading cases on the First Amendment is the Pentagon Papers, where, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post got a hold of a lot of sort of embarrassing Pentagon secrets, some of which might, you know, still had some relevance to ongoing things, and a lot of them were really embarrassing for the government. And, you know, the court conceded that this was not going to do any good and probably would do some harm, but there was no imminent danger to anyone, and the court let them publish it. And so, you know, if there were some imminent danger to somebody, I think you could come up with some tailored measure to keep the publication from happening, but not the application from being completely banned.
Thank you.
Thanks. Yes.
Over here on the side microphone. You need to look to your left. Yes, thank you. Joe Cosby from Washington, D.C. I have to confess some confusion with Mr. Estrada's argument that naming TikTok specifically is a more restrictive regulation than a more general thing that presumably affects more individuals and entities, and that's written in somewhat vaguer, necessarily vaguer language that presumably reaches more conduct than the specific conduct that we may be talking about with TikTok. So could you explain that a little bit further? But then a question to Mr. Philbin, why isn't naming TikTok specifically and banning TikTok not an unconstitutional bill of attainder?
Miguel, you want to start?
I'm not sure what you're asking me to explain. I mean, you know, the statute has two parts, really. One of them essentially conclusively deems TikTok to be a foreign adversary controlled application and bans it unless it is sold. And even if it is sold, it cannot sort of have its content be collaborative.
So my question then was, you characterized the broader, what I thought was the broader section as less restrictive, and I wasn't able to follow that would be less restrictive rather than more.
Sure, it is less restrictive because it then goes on to define a category of applications that are also controlled by Russia, China, North Korea, or Iran, that engage in the same activities, content, et cetera, that have a certain number of subscribers, and that could potentially be banned, but are not banned, but that in order to be banned, you know, the president has to make a proposal to ban them, they have to get a hearing, and the president has to propose what is it that they would have to divest of with specific reasons as to why. And that's an avenue that was not made available to TikTok and would have allowed a procedural protection to TikTok that was not made available.
Let me turn to Pat, and then we will go to the next person. Pat.
Sure, so on the bill of attainder question, I mean, the first answer is I don't think the Supreme Court has ever applied the bill of attainder to corporations.
That's correct.
Natural persons, and that's a big part of the government's argument in the D.C. Circuit case, but also the traditional test for figuring out whether it's a bill of attainder focuses a lot on, is this purely punitive? Is this just something to punish someone for past action, or does it involve an element of regulating future conduct? And I think here, clearly, it would not be just punitive. It's about stopping something from happening in the future. It's a regulation on the ownership layer and having that ownership layer that's headquartered in the PRC. So it would not count as a bill of attainder.
Got it. Who's next and where?
In the middle.
Center mic, I'm told.
Hi, Gideon Rappaport from New Jersey. I had a question about the algorithm component. So I think both sides agree that you can see the same cat video or the same video about Osama bin Laden's manifesto on other platforms as well, so it's not about that. But since cryptographic algorithms are regulated by the International Traffic in Arms Act, and they cannot be exported without a license, with the penalty of not having a license being essentially life imprisonment, why can't we just target the algorithm and either force it to be open source or force it to be different or somehow tailored to the US market in a way that doesn't have these national security concerns? Because another thing that hasn't come up is that the Chinese actually do not use the same algorithm that they export to other countries for their domestic TikTok market. It's effectively a different closed app behind the Great Firewall of China, within China, and they don't expose their own youth to the type of things, including very traumatizing content, as they expose youth in other parts of the world.
Miguel, I think that may be for you.
Well, I think one of the content-based arguments is that, you know, the Chinese are essentially exporting damaging content to our youth that they don't expose their youth to, and I think that's what makes this content-based. Whether that's a good enough argument to sustain the statute is one of the issues in the case. To me, that makes it content-based. It is, you know, they are trying to harm us with content. It may be true, But that only sort of raises the issue whether it's content-based. With respect to your other question as to whether you could ban the algorithm or whether you could sort of subject it to some other international sort of entity, I think, you know, the issue there is whether you can force the Chinese to give up the intellectual property that they claim, as Pat said, is governed by Chinese law. I mean, I take it that we and the Europeans, I mean, this is not like something that is uniquely, you know, nefarious on the part of the Chinese. We would take probably an analogous view with respect to the protections that U.S. law provides to the intellectual property that we give to our companies. And the Europeans, you know, would do the same thing, I imagine.
Yeah, you might be reaching the technical limits of our ability to discuss the algorithm, but I think I think Miguel is right. There'd be issues with trying to force it to be open source, and I'm not sure about the distinction between a cryptographic algorithm and others, but there's also, I believe that what has happened is that TikTok has said they'll provide all of the code for the algorithm as it would be used outside China in the United States, to Oracle. Oracle took a look at it and said, there's 2 billion lines of code here. It will take us 3 years to try to figure this out. So whether, even if they were willing to share it on some limited basis, whether that could actually be policed in any effective way, they say that it takes thousands of engineers, software engineers, to maintain it in China. I just don't know. But the information in the DC Circuit case suggests that that's a Herculean task that Oracle doesn't really seem to say that we're down for it, we'll get it done.
You could always just ask ChatGPT and see what it tells you. Side microphone.
Yeah, to the left again, David Axelman from Tallahassee, Florida. My question is for Miguel. I was hoping you could maybe elaborate on why other platforms like YouTube or Instagram would not be considered an ample alternative channel of communication. I think you mentioned TikTok is easy to use, maybe more efficient. But do YouTube and Instagram really have to offer all of the same features as TikTok? Do they really have to guarantee access to all of the same worldwide viewers that TikTok can reach in order to be considered an ample alternative channel of communication?
Well, I think there are really two issues there. I mean, I think that there is a question about what the speaker user is choosing to do in coming in to sort of express himself or herself, what he or she finds is useful in the application that he doesn't find elsewhere to convey his point of view. And these people have already voted with their feet, right? I mean, you have, you know, declarations and affidavits in the DC Circuit from people who are creators, for example, who have tried all of the apps and who say that they have a larger reach and they have, like, succeeded a lot better or exponentially better in this application with the tools that they have. You have, like, Snips and CapCap and all of these things that, since I am completely computer illiterate, I don't really understand, but apparently maximize the degree of creativity that they can bring to these little films, you know, that they post in the app. And I think that that's part of, if you are a creator, that's part of the judgment, you know, that you bring. If you're going to put a theater piece and you think that this is how you're going to staff, you know, your actors, you know, you want, you know, Sophia Loren and not somebody else, this is how you're going to do it, and tell you that you have to have, you know, Demi Moore doesn't quite cut it. Now, the other one is what the Supreme Court said in the NetChoice case, which is from the other side, from the TikTok side, which is the right of the editor to collate and compile. And they have a First Amendment right too. And, you know, just as the Wall Street Journal editorial page has a right of center bent, and they gather people that they think will sort of show that bent, and the New York Times has a left of center bent, these are not sort of interchangeable. And finally, what ties them together is what the First Amendment calls, you know, the right of expressive association. You know, the people who find this a congenial algorithm for their expression, finding the editor who actually sort of will put all of these people together and so they can all work together. But all of these three things are all First Amendment rights. You know, the editing and collating, the people who want to create, and the right to all of them to actually associate with each other. And they're not sort of things that can be forced into a different medium, under the First Amendment, at least.
Next, I'm getting the hang of it. Right
okay.
There.
Greg Tufel in Pittsburgh. I guess this question is for Mr. Estrada.
I'm getting all the questions here.
Yeah, sorry. If the ban took the form of saying that TikTok is banned so long unless and until they divest a certain amount of foreign adversary ownership or stop sending data to Beijing, such that it really wouldn't be banning the app, but it would be banning the foreign or adversary ownership and or banning the foreign adversary transmission of data, would that eliminate the First Amendment concerns and be an allowable type of ban?
I think that's more or less equivalent to what this statute does. I think the rub here is whether you can actually make the app function without the intellectual property. And if the people who have the rights to the intellectual property under law, which may well be Chinese, will not let you divest without letting go of the intellectual property, I think that ban would be equivalent. I think what I would say about that is whether if there is a concern about the use of the intellectual property, the correct First Amendment answer, at least in the first instance, is to identify what the concern is, to answer the question that I answer when I first answer Pat, which is it potential or is it actual? And is it one that is shared uniformly by this app and other apps? And are there measures short of suppression of speech that you can use to address, or measures that are less restrictive of what you're contemplating of speech?
Pat, do you have any?
No, I think Miguel is right that the question, I think, largely tracked what this current statute does. It is about the ownership and stopping the flows. There's one thing that Miguel said, though, that I would make a note on, and that is the idea, is it a potential problem or actual problem? And I think that because it's national security issues at stake here, that the Supreme Court's jurisprudence gives a lot more leeway for the government to be basing its actions on potential problems, on understandings and predictions of the political branches about potential national security issues, because you don't have to wait until that actually happens, until there has actually been the catastrophic failure of the communication system through a software that puts malware on 170 handsets. You can anticipate that and take action. So I think that is an important aspect of this. In that national security realm, the Supreme Court almost universally defers to assessments of the political branches about what the risks and national security concerns are. The Supreme Court then decides what the law and the First Amendment is, but it doesn't demand proof that those risks have already materialized.
I'm sorry, I think next person there.
Yes, sir. Hi, Trey Donathan from George Washington Law. Social media accounts have created some interesting property issues, such as the buying and selling of social media accounts, or when there are joint accounts with couples that separate, there being property disputes between them. So how might the banning of TikTok be a property rights issue as a seizing and destruction of Americans' property?
Pat?
Well, I don't think that just regulation by the government of the ownership of this app could translate into an actionable case for, say, a taking of property, because the government's not actually seizing property from anyone, and regulatory takings are very difficult to try to establish. They'd have to be eliminating all value of something, and I don't even know the extent to which people can monetize. I mean, you can monetize, I guess, a YouTube account. Can you monetize a TikTok account? I guess people are
you
not.
Can.
Yeah, so they would have
If the creators wouldn't be quite as enthusiastic about TikTok
right.
if you couldn't monetize them.
So, but I don't think that simply regulating the ownership layer of the app, which could have trickle-down effects on how effective the app is, could translate into a regulatory taking claim.
I am sort of agnostic on this. I don't think the question has arisen yet, because if in fact you cannot successfully transfer it and you have to shut it down, you have essentially killed a lot of value. I mean, sort of apart from the fact that you have shuttered, you know, the ability of 170 million people to convey a message, and of TikTok to curate, you know, that message, the enterprise itself has value. And so if there cannot be a successful transfer, and leaving aside the First Amendment question, it is an enterprise with a going concern value, which if it's forced to shut down, presumably will cause economic loss to somebody. And so I'm sort of agnostic on the question. I mean, it is not a ripe question yet, but it is, you know, it can arguably be viewed as an arbitrary exercise of government power that actually results in a loss of billions of dollars.
Next person in the middle.
Yes. I'm Marianne Mele from New Jersey. I love the jurisprudential discussion here, but oftentimes the courts and lawyers are years behind the technology. So my first observation is, when you see a spy balloon collecting American data, you shoot it down. The problem here is not the person posting their kitty cat on TikTok, but the information that flows from that posting, and how do we shoot that information down, and why not ask Elon, and he could do it in his spare time.
Competitor, Elon. Miguel.
Well, I think that that's an interesting question because, you know, we have courts that are, you know, reactive, and we have courts that are governed by a system of precedent. And just last term, we had, you know, the cases that went to the Supreme Court from Texas and Florida having to do with the ability of states to deal with the ability of social media to regulate content. And, you know, the reaction of the Supreme Court in the NetChoice cases was not to view the medium as something that was novel and that called for completely new sets of rules, but to analogize to newspapers. And that's where the editorial curating analogy comes from, right? Justice Kagan in NetChoice went to the Tornillo case and said that just as an editor in a newspaper curates what it's going to publish, YouTube and Facebook also engage in an editorial function that is covered by the First Amendment. Yes, maybe Elon can fix all of the problems that we face, but he's currently busy with other things. I will point out, though, that he does furnish sort of a good example of something else, which is he bought Twitter, now X, and there are a lot of people out there who believe, rightly or wrongly, that that actually changed, you know, the nature of the forum and the way that the forum is actually presented, and that the community notes and other sort of features of it have changed, and now there is a cavalcade of people who also may be moving to Canada, who are leaving, you know, the forum. They don't find it equivalent to what they had before.
So I have three things I wanted to say. One is, I was just wondering a few days ago, can you sue for specific performance if somebody says, I promise to move to Canada if a certain condition proceeds to satisfy? I mean, you could say, I actually took time and effort to vote a particular way. That's the consideration. The second thing is, I was asked to say the following. The next session is in the Columbia Room, which is across from registration. And after the third thing, all attendees should please make their way out of the ballroom so it can be prepared for the 4:30 lecture, which will be back in this ballroom. That's the second thing. And the third thing is simply to thank the panelists for an excellent, excellent debate. I have enjoyed it very much, as I hope you have as well. And thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.